Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. As any true gardener knows, gardens transfix. They absorb us on our knees in the dirt on the garden path, a garden bench. We get lost in work and time and maybe dreams. We always have, says Stanford Don Robert Pogue Harrison. And the reasons are deep. Back to the gardens of Babylon, the Garden of Eden. This hour, On Point, the garden. In the backyard, in history, in literature, in the human soul. You can join the conversation. What's the root of our love of the garden? Joining me now from Rome is Robert Pogue Harrison, professor of Italian literature at Stanford University. He's a celebrated cultural historian whose previous books have explored forests and burial grounds and their meanings for the human psyche and civilization. His new book, loaded with Babylon and Eden and Boccaccio and Versailles, is called Gardens, an Essay on the Human Condition. Professor Harrison, welcome to On Point. Thanks for being with us.
It's a pleasure to be here, Tom. Thank you.
Gardening, you write, is an opening of worlds within worlds, beginning with the world at one's feet. You start there and take us on quite a journey. How did you set off on this inquiry, Professor?
Well, it didn't happen in any deliberate way. I was solicited to write an essay on gardens as a result of the book I wrote on forests. And as I got into the theme for a shorter essay of about 25 pages, I discovered that there were indeed worlds within worlds when it comes to the topic of gardens, and I felt like I wanted to get to the bottom of it, as it were. You were using that metaphor of getting through the soil into the humus, as it were, and that's what I tried to do.
It's an incredible span of time, all the way back from the mythic and religious through real gardens that you take us on. In this work, what's your approach? Is it historical? Is it literary? Is it philosophical? Does it have to be all three when it comes to the garden?
I tried to include all three, to tell you the truth, and maybe in the back of my mind was Voltaire's famous dictum that we must cultivate our garden, which he proposes at the end of his novel Candide as an ethical as well as philosophical stance of being in the world, and that no matter how bad things are, there is a responsibility to cultivate and to find that, open up a little plot in which one can care for something in a way that counters the deleterious and destructive forces of the world. And I believe that that can take place literally by creating your little garden, but also in a number of other cultural respects. In fact, the word culture has its roots in the soil, as it were. And I discuss a number of ways in which gardening can serve as the analog for such activities, be it education or democracy, friendship, marriage, certain virtues, all of which require a caretaking on the part of either the citizen, the husband, or the friend, etc.
It's fascinating. I mean, reading you here, you're quite up front. You're not exactly an avid gardener yourself, but your love and interpretation of the garden, metaphysical, metaphorical, and real, goes very deep here. You really start in the Garden of Eden, and you take lessons there that leave you, well, when you're writing about gardens and you're devoting the book to Eve and her daughters, to women, you say. They're sort of the owners of the garden, though they're hardly the only gardeners.
No, they're not the only gardeners, but since Eve over the centuries and millennia has taken the blame for the fall, I thought that she should also get the credit for our expulsion from that original garden in which everything was provided spontaneously without effort, labor, or pain. And I believe that by eating, that act of transgression put humanity on the track to its own self-realization by turning us into caretakers of the earth, tillers of the soil, and creatures who realize their potential through their cultivating and nurturing activities. So I wanted to give her her due, as it were.
It's fascinating. When you talk about the garden, you really ride a line between paradise and garden. And this issue of care, paradise often a garden where no effort is required, and that ultimately unsatisfying for humans. It's something about having to get down on your knees and get your fingernails dirty, get your hands in the soil, that makes the garden the garden, that gives it its depth, its bottom for us.
It certainly is the case. And not being an avid gardener myself, in fact, I'm not really a gardener at all, and I feel a little bit guilty about writing a book without knowing firsthand what is the deep satisfaction that gardeners derive from their daily activity. But I've read enough about it, and I know enough gardeners to know that it's a very real thing. And this sort of satisfaction that one takes in one's own labors and nurturing efforts, I believe is a far greater source of human happiness than is something like the mere consumption of freely given goods. And if we want to talk broadly about one of the ethical messages that I try to convey in the book as a whole, is that cultivation is a much deeper source of human happiness than is consumption. And that it's difficult when we talk about the Eden motif to draw the fine line between all the suffering and toil and death and pain that being mortal mm-hmm. and being cast out of the garden entails for humanity. And our forebears have certainly sweat tears and blood and have consigned them into the soil over the millennia. And one cannot blame anyone for seeking to be liberated from the bondage that our relationship to the earth has committed us to.
You will earn your bread by the sweat of your brow once you're out
yes,
of that
you
garden.
Yes, you do. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But you're welcoming that as a kind of fulfillment of humanness at the same time.
Yes, I welcome it. I don't want to be naive about saying that it's fine as long as we embrace it. I don't want to underestimate the degree of pain and suffering that it entails, but I believe that there's evidence enough to be relatively certain that if we were able to recreate Eden, as our society is attempting to do in many ways, our consumer society, let's say, that we would quickly become very dissatisfied. And I'm not saying that we would long for a world where pain is part of the everyday experience of being in the world, but however, there is no, there is, to use one of those cliches, gain without pain.
A little sore back, a little dirty knee, and there's an engagement there with nature, with the worldly, with the effort, the care you say is required to give something
yes.
value. Robert Polk Harrison, stand by there in Rome if you would. We've got lots of maybe gardeners who already want to join this conversation. Let's go to Christine in Northampton, Massachusetts. Christine, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks. This is a great topic, actually. After years of frustratingly trying to grow vegetables in a city, I have become a community garden participant in Northampton.
Good for you.
It's absolutely amazing. There's 400 plots. There are people who are doing butterfly gardens, very formal English-style herb gardens, lots of vegetables, but just that whole sense of helping your neighbor out and that by the way, very, very sore back and dirty knees.
Right.
It's just pretty, it's better than therapy. We go up every day after work and dig around and see what's happened and see beetles eating things and get frustrated and then see some successes.
And Christine, when you step into the midst of those 400 plots and all the labor and all the growth that's going on there, you cite the community that you feel, but what's the shared experience that's taking people somewhere? What's going on in those minds as people get down in a half meditative state in the dirt?
Well, what I really find is I've lived in this town for 15 years. I've met people that I've never known. It's a small college community. I've met people that I probably should have met but hadn't. And we all do very different things. Some of us are teachers. Some are politicians. Some are perpetual students. Some are just families trying to save some money on food bills this summer. And we all are taking a very vested interest in each other's successes within the garden. And it's kind of everybody's on a level playing field, if that makes any sense.
Mm-hmm.
There's just a real appreciation and admiration for people's successes, and we share in each other's failures with the frustration of the raccoon getting in and tearing something up, and, you know, then that first carrot that gets pulled.
Right, the patch of soil and the sunshine and the rain, and you share those, and that's a lot. Christine, thanks for your call. Robert Pogue Harrison, even in your sort of literary terms, there's a community factor that's huge here, because even in metaphorical terms, when we step into the garden, we're stepping into some common ground that humans share.
That's certainly the case. In fact, I have a chapter on real community gardens, as well as the homeless gardens in New York City, where I try to show that through the experience that was just being described by the caller, neighborhoods come together and consolidate themselves through in the garden and by virtue of their gardening activity. And this motif of community and garden runs also throughout the history of philosophy as well as the history of literature. It's quite extraordinary that the earliest academies, or let's say institutions of higher education, for example, Plato's Academy or the Garden School of Epicurus, were places where communities formed actually in gardens and where the discourse of philosophy continued within the garden.
Robert Polk Harrison, hold the thought right there, if you would. We'll come back and dive straight into that. The new book is Gardens, an Essay on the Human Condition. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back in the garden. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about gardens and the garden in the backyard, in history, in literature, in the human soul. My guest joining us today from Rome is Robert Pogue Harrison, professor of Italian literature at Stanford University. He's author of a wonderful new book. It's called Gardens, an Essay on the Human Condition. Professor Harrison, there's a wonderful Czech who you quote at some length in here from the 1920s who loved his gardens and wrote about them, and knew gardeners well. I think you pronounce it, Carol, is it Chapek? Chapek?
I think it's Chapok, but I call him Chapek.
Okay, Chapek. I wish you'd read just a little bit from here, and we're going to range widely in dipping into literature here, but here he's just writing about how to recognize the gardener. And he's got a kind of a wonderful take on this that any gardener or anyone in a gardener's ambit will recognize here. Could you read some for us?
Certainly. So Chapek writes, "I will now tell you how to recognize a real gardener. You must come to see me," he says. "I will show you my garden. Then when you go just to please him, you will find him with his rump sticking up somewhere among the perennials. I will come in a moment," he shouts to you over his shoulder. "Just wait till I have planted this rose." "Please don't worry," you say kindly to him. After a while, he must have planted it, for he gets up, makes your hand dirty, and beaming with hospitality, he says, "Come and have a look. It's a small garden, but wait a moment." And he bends over a bed to weed some tiny grass. "Come along. I will show you Dianthus musalia. It will open your eyes. Great Scott, I forgot to loosen it here," he says, and begins to poke in the soil. A quarter of an hour later, he straightens up again. "Ah," he says, "I wanted to show you that bell flower, Campanula wilsone. This is the best Campanula, which, wait a moment, I must tie up this delphinium." After he has tied it up, he remembers, "Oh, I see, you have come to see the erodium." "A moment," he murmurs. "I must just transplant this aster. It hasn't enough room here." After that, you go away on tiptoe, leaving him behind, leaving his behind sticking up among the perennials.
That's wonderful. From Carol, Chapek, you name it. But
Chapek.
I think Chapek, he's caught the gardener, and that's exactly the gardener. "Great to see you. I must show you my garden immediately." And off we go. You write that for millennia and throughout world cultures, our predecessors conceived of human happiness in its perfected state as a garden existence. And we should begin to sort of walk us from deep in history forward on that front. You talked about Plato and potato. I'm ready to plant here. Plato and Epicurus just before the break. But begin to take us back to your kind of early reference points in understanding our relationship with the garden.
Well, the earliest literary work to come down to us, as far as we know, is the Epic of Gilgamesh. And that epic has actually two fantastical gardens beyond the confines of the known human world. And Gilgamesh, who is suffering precisely from mortality and his fear of death, he seeks for immortality. Mm. And he goes on a desperate journey to meet the only man to whom the gods have given everlasting life, Utnapishtim. And once he reaches that garden, he's told that now he can't stay there. He has to go back to his earthly city and accept his fate as a mortal human being. So that's one sort of garden where it's perpetual spring, there's no pain, there's no death, and there's this constant sort of enjoyment of pleasures of and fruits and clement weather.
This is the paradise garden without labor, bushes bearing gems, fruit of carnelian, lapis lazuli leaves, agate and pearls from out of the sea, and that kind of paradise.
Right, exactly. And there are others very similar, if not these kind of mineral gardens, in the Odyssey, for example, and in Greek mythology in general. There are the Isles of the Blessed, the Elysian Fields, and we know that Menelaus, for example, among the Greek Achaeans, is the one who is granted this extraordinary privilege of being the one person who will not have to die, but will be transported directly to another garden environment in the far-flung oceans. Mm. But what I point out, if you don't mind,
please,
is that in the same epic of the Odyssey where we're told about this place, what do we find? We find Odysseus on the island of Calypso, which in every respect is exactly like the Isles of the Blessed. And Calypso is it's a garden environment. Calypso offers him immortality, and yet all he does, Odysseus, is go to the shore and sulk. He just wants to go home and reassume his responsibilities, his cares, and to be immortal. And that's early evidence that perhaps these garden places like Eden are rather sterile places for someone who is fundamentally human the way Odysseus is human.
You write that Dilmun from Gilgamesh, I guess, and Elysium offer ease and perpetual spring at the cost of an absolute isolation from the world of mortals, isolation from friends, family, city, the ongoing story of human action and endeavor, exile from both the private and public spheres of human interaction, a sorry condition, even if it's in a kind of paradise. Let's get a call from Williamsburg, Virginia, and Jake. Jake, you're on the air.
Hi there. I'm a church historian, actually, who is currently in the horticultural department on hiatus from teaching for a while at the College of William & Mary, just working in the soil and helping to cultivate this very old garden here.
How wonderful. You've taken Voltaire's advice, Jake.
Yes, certainly. And I don't think that it's too different of a work. I really am starting to make the connections to church history. As you know, the biblical history takes the garden from the origins of man and the world into the Messiah figure himself, who is a olive tree, you know, something that would have been cultivated in the Middle East, and where gardeners themselves would have to take much care, and it's considered a place of rest, as he is considered a place of rest, and the church is considered a tree with many branches, and a place of rest. But the interesting thing about it is that it's also a place of work, a place of toil and of thorns and thistles. And it just amazes me, and I'm trying to figure out what it would have been to have toil and dominion and the keeping of the garden prior to what we historically called the fall. And I just, it seems mind-boggling to me and something I cannot comprehend, because work and toil and flood and famine is so a part of the gardening process. Not having enough water, enough sun, I fight the weeds back and they keep coming. And so it just seems to be the story of old, and I can't think of another one. I can't imagine what a garden without the toil would look like.
Robert Pogue Harrison, Jake is right on your terrain here, the sort of dialectic between Adam and Eve taking out of that paradise garden, heading out for where the weeds are.
Yes, and of course, Eden is also the place where Eve is born, at least in one of the Genesis accounts. So in a strange way, although Eve takes with her a certain nostalgia for Eden, and yet is also the cultivator and the caretaker. And what your caller is describing, I think, is very interesting with respect to the way in which gardens, I think, although they entail toil and work, but in many cases what we're trying to do is also create little pockets of Eden in the midst of what some people might consider the hell of reality. And the deep satisfaction of creating these pockets, these Edenic pockets, is that they actually are our own creation. Not exactly our creation, because we cannot create the life that we foster in gardens. That has a source of its own. But what we can do is enable, nurture, sponsor, Yes, we find repose in this kind of work. So I think that's very true.
The gardens that have graced this mortal Eden, you write, of ours, are best evidence of humanity's reason for being on Earth. We must seek out healing or redemptive forces and allow them to grow in us. Jake, thanks very much for your call. Let's get one from Yuta in Marblehead, Massachusetts. Yuta, you're on the air.
Yes, hello, and thank you so much for having me speak a few words. I'm 70 years old, and I'm a passionate gardener. I believe nature provides our natural healing. I have done 11 gardens from beginnings in my life because I moved a lot, and I look forward to reading Professor Harrison's new book. I believe the seasons in our garden are connected absolutely to the seasons of our lifetime here on Earth. There is so much joy and so much surprise, hard work too, but it's a passion. When the world wearies and society ceases to satisfy, there is always the garden. This is one of my favorite quotes. I wanted to write a little book eventually, if I get around to it. And I feel my little tiny garden in Marblehead that started under sort of sad circumstances is now, in over 6 years, has grown into a secret garden. But I think I changed the word secret to sacred. I feel very, very close to the Creator when I'm in this little garden. And it's attracting all sorts of people that walk by. So the longing for all of us to be close to nature is so deep-seated. One of my favorite books is called The Wild Braid, written by Stanley Kunitz, who died just after he turned 100, and he was a passionate gardener and a poet. And I just liked his work very much.
Oh, Yuta, you paint a beautiful, beautiful picture there. We thank you for sharing it. Robert Pogue Harrison, Secret and Sacred, both themes that I pick up in your book as well.
When it comes there is something healing. The garden does have a healing power in, again, in the literal as well as figurative senses, because there is considerable evidence that the first gardens were cultivated for herbal medicines and healing agents. But at the same time, as the caller suggested, the creating of the gardens, or the making and supervision of them, has a healing effect on the soul. And the passage from my book, which you quoted just prior, about seeking out the redemptive and healing forces within us and allowing them to grow, I think speaks directly to that as well. So this closeness, this need to find oneself in close proximity to the very sources of vitality and of life, vegetable life, what I would call our chlorophylia,
right.
Our need, our basic need for green around us. Mm. For most of us, I told, although I was telling one of my colleagues about this chlorophylia, he said, well, I can show you 100 people on Wall Street on any block who don't have any chlorophylia.
Not a touch of it.
but I think most of us suffer when we're deprived of green in a way that we probably don't even suspect what is the source of this malaise, and we ascribe it to other psychological causes, personal or existential. But as soon as we're in a garden or in a park or some kind of natural setting, all of a sudden that malaise kind of vanishes magically. So I do agree.
Mm. Yuta, thanks for your call. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We've touched on mythical gardens. You go to historic gardens as well. We should pick out a couple which you find the most loaded with resonance with their own particular story.
Yes, the real gardens that I deal with, I mean real in the sense that they're existing. The Italian Renaissance garden is something that interests me as an Italian, as that's my primary, mm-hmm. that's my main profession. And I studied the history of the Italian Renaissance gardens and found that it's very interesting in the way the Italians knew and still know how to conjugate life and form. I think this is one way to conceive of these kind of gardens. And they do it without trying to conceal the artfulness of the gardens, the way the English garden typically tries to conceal the artifice in order to allow nature to appear as it's as unfettered. Nor is it like the French, typical French classical garden, where the artifice is so heavy-handed that it seems to have completely subjugated and dominated nature. And this sort of naturalness in the Italian aesthetic is something that I find also reflected in Italian literature. So, for example, I have a chapter on Boccaccio, mm-hmm. the author of the Decameron, mm-hmm. who wrote a book about it takes place in the year 1348, which is the year of the Black Death,
right.
in Florence, where the whole society has succumbed to complete anarchy and disorder, and a group of 10 young people remove themselves to the margins of that chaos into a garden in order to tell stories for a period of 10 days, 2 weeks, and reconstitute the social communal bonds that have all but been shattered in the town of Florence. And in there, again, we're talking about healing, reconstituting, and re-socializing, rehumanizing the world. And the gardens in which they're telling these stories are very much like... they're very much the Italian Renaissance gardens. But the way Boccaccio tells stories, his Decameron itself, follows the same aesthetic principles as the Italian Renaissance gardens. This is of interest to me, yeah.
You've got Edith Wharton here talking about Italian villas and their gardens and the kind of subtraction that goes on to get down to those fundamentals of the garden, thinking away the flowers, the sunlight, the rich tinting of time. By doing that, she writes, one finds that underlying all these is a deeper harmony of design. When we come back, we'll hear from Irene Virag of Newsday, garden columnist with her own take on this world. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. We're We're joined right now as well from Fort Salonga, New York, on Long Island by Irene Virag. She's a garden columnist at Newsday, a writer for Better Homes and Gardens and Garden Magazine. Her website is irenevirag.com. Irene, thank you so much for being with us today.
Hi, thanks so much. It's a delight to be here.
We're enjoying lingering in the garden and gardens across eons here with Professor Harrison. You're a gardener who actually gets your fingers in the dirt. Do you see high philosophy, ancient history, and the backyard garden is tied up together, Irene, or in different realms?
I think everything comes together in the garden. I really see the garden as a metaphor for life and death, for rebirth, for survival, for hope, for renewal. It really is all in the garden. And the struggle is part of the joy, as one of your callers and a lot of the discussion has been indicating. Gardeners, I have found, are some of the most sharing people around. We share seeds and cuttings, we share knowledge, we share advice. And I have always believed that there's something deep within our DNA that makes us want to till the earth, want to get our hands dirty, want to touch it. And for me, in my own life, there's another reason for my thinking of the garden as a metaphor, and it has to do with the wild seed called breast cancer that invaded my own body. And it was during that time when I was in the middle of chemotherapy that I and my husband tore up a large part of our very suburban front lawn and planted a combination vegetable and flower garden where we grow wonderful organic vegetables and beautiful flowers, and we started with compost, which is truly one of the basics of a good garden. The garden has, from the very moment we started it, it has whispered of hope. It was planted in a season when I got sick from chemotherapy and burned by radiation, and it has always whispered of tomorrow to me. And it might sound corny, but we call it our garden of health and joy.
We don't think it's corny. We're glad it helped pull you through. Robert Polk Harrison looks in particular at gender. He goes all the way back to the Garden of Eden, and he sees Adam and Eve really in some ways in different postures toward the garden. He gives women credit. He gives Eve credit for sort of getting us out of that, garden that lives and thrives without our effort and in getting our fingers in the soil. You and your husband have worked there together. You've written and looked at gardens for a long time. Do you see, when you go very deep here, Irene, do you see a fundamentally different relationship between men and women when they get in the soil of the garden, or do we share all that across gender lines?
It's been one of the enduring mysteries to me how it is that, in my experience, it seems like men are into the vegetable gardening. I don't know. Maybe it's got something to do with wanting to be, the provider. And women have, for men, I always think it's got something to do with zucchini envy. It's like they want to outdo each other with their, their big bountiful vegetables. And women in my experience are this is certainly not across the board, but seem a little gentler with wanting to tend flowers, and it's just one of those wonderful wonderful things about the garden.
Professor Harrison, there in Rome, you bring in a poet, a man, Andrew Marvell, and his poem, The Garden. He takes it to a very sort of high philosophical level, using it as metaphor. There's a little bit I wish you'd read for us. Perhaps you can set up how he's using the garden here in this poem and read a bit for us.
Okay. First, I'd like to tell Irene I really like her articles.
Oh, good.
Those that I've read.
Yes.
Thank you so much.
Yeah.
I think it really is writing about gardens is just one of the best gigs. I used to be a news reporter where I used to have to sort of convince people that it would be a good thing for them to talk to me. And when I got onto the garden beat, it was just a great joy to call somebody up and they would say, "Come visit my garden. Let me show you around. I'll make you a cup of tea." And And it was just a joy. So go ahead.
Well, that's right along Marvel's line, and you write, Robert Harrison, the psyche. He's writing here about the garden's recesses, the psychic depths that the garden opens up in its visitor.
Yeah, the famous poem by Andrew Marvell, The Garden, that refers to specific types of gardens, specifically, you know, the English garden, which many of them, Stowe, Stourhead, where it has an itinerary of that you walk along paths and you discover things or little secret recesses. And I think the purpose of these, let's say, more philosophical English gardens was to provide places of self-discovery, places of meditation. In fact, the garden and meditation has a cross-cultural connection, I think, with the Japanese gardens, for example. And in this poem of his, it culminates with these lines where Marvell writes, "The mind, that ocean where each kind does straight its own resemblance find, yet it creates, transcending these, far other worlds and other seas, annihilating all that's made to a green thought in a green shade." Mm-hmm. I bring this up to say that gardens are also places of spiritual concentration, where the mind is free to divagate, wander, and explore recesses of its own nature that finds its reflection in the garden as such. And, of course, this requires time on our part. I don't think we can do it in the 2 hours that most tourists spend in these gardens when they arrive in tour buses, do a tour of the grounds, and then get back on the bus and go to the next place. These are gardens where this kind of spiritual discovery would require giving yourself enough time to sink into those depths of deep time that are part of the human psyche as well.
Mm-hmm. They're the formal garden or the Zen garden, or even on the right day, just a garden patch in that community garden. Robert Harrison, please stand by. Jolly's calling from Avon, Connecticut. Jolly, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
Love your show. And I just wanted to say that in addition to what other callers were saying, for me, gardening is very therapeutic. I find it that when I'm gardening, all the physical energy that I want to take off, I find that relieving when I can do that outside in the gardens. And also, when I'm looking at the flowers that are being produced from the plants that I have just put in the soil, it's so exhilarating, so therapeutic to see some of these vegetables giving me the flowers, giving me the peace and freedom, giving me the sense of nurturing. Because sometimes when I go out and I look at my plants growing, I look at it as a miracle. I look at it as a blessing from God. I say, wow, how can I just plant this and then the next day it's giving me more fruits? However, I also wanted to say that I originally come from Uganda in East Africa.
Yes.
There, gardening is taken as a sense of community get-together, because when we harvest, we invite everyone to come and rejoice with us because of the harvesting we have done. And that also gives us a sense of making friends, sharing, and appreciating each other. Thank you.
Jolly, we love it. Thank you so much for that. Let's get one more from Henry here. Let the men speak to their garden as well. Henry in Plainville, Connecticut. You're on the air.
Well, thank you very much, Tom.
Yeah.
You mentioned, one of your guests mentioned earlier, Carol Chapek, a favorite playwright of mine, presaging robotics with his play R.U.R. and nuclear power or bombs with Krakatoa.
Is that right? The same Czech writer who had our rumps in the air in the garden? Okay, I didn't know about his reign.
Yeah, he should not be forgotten. But for the purposes of this conversation about gardening and immortality, I recently noticed that I have some pawpaw trees that have just recently appeared in my garden, and I had forgotten that I had even planted these things probably 8 years ago. So I probably should have marked them with a gravestone when I planted them. And I'm looking forward to 10 years of growth probably before I ever even harvest a pawpaw, but seems like I'll have to be immortal to totally appreciate this garden.
Yeah, the garden that goes on that we can't always entirely stay with, and yet we know it's going to go on. Henry, thanks for that. Robert Polk Harrison, you write wonderfully about reaching into Dante and the garden as the kind of anteroom to paradise. I mean, well, of course, Eden plays a huge role here, but he's almost obsessed with the garden and that sort of tension of effort and even ecstasy that the garden brings.
Yes, I wanted to say one thing about Chapek, that the that play R.U.R., which I actually discussed because it's about the human race inventing a race of robots. In fact, Chapek was the first person to coin the word robot. Mm. And, of course, they're trying to recreate Eden very explicitly. And the only person to survive the Holocaust is someone who is critical of the that human attempt. So, but to get back now to Dante, I have a chapter on Dante, and in which I also discuss the garden in Islam in the Quran, where I point out that there are two different visions of paradise in Islam and in Christianity. In Islam, the paradise is really the terrestrial paradise. It's really Eden. And there are many, many references to Eden in the Quran. And it's described very vividly, very sensually, its pleasures, the fruits and the shade and the running water and the virgin and so forth. And it's a very reposeful place of serenity. In Dante's Divine Comedy, which is where one gets the most full-bodied expression of the Christian vision of paradise, when Dante reaches the Garden of Eden at the end of Purgatorio, he and Beatrice only spend a few hours there because it's only a halfway place. It's a stopping point, and then they ascend to the stars, and they go through planetary spheres to what's called the Imperium, which is where all the blessed saints actually dwell. And this Imperium is described as a celestial rose. It's an amphitheater as compared to a rose. It's really a very rarefied garden, if you like. Mm. It's also located beyond the continuum of space and time. It's it's a completely spiritualized place which doesn't have a physical... it doesn't have physical coordinates,
and at that point, a kind of tension there between the ecstatic expansion into all that goes on, and the serenity of that Islamic garden. We'll have to look at that. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Our time's running down, but there's a little bit of Dante that you might read to take us right to that sort of jumping off point from the earthly garden on into that yearning what kind of cosmic paradise?
Right. Well, this is in Paradiso 30, where he and Beatrice are looking into this river of light, and they're seeing all these angels who are like bees plunging into the flowers. I'll read a little bit of the Italian to give you a sense of what it sounds like. E vidi lume in forma di rivera, fulvide fulgore intra due rive dipinte di mirabile primavera. Di tal fiumana uscivan faville vive, ed ogni parte si mettian nei fiori, quasi rubin che oro circumscrive. And in the English, it says, and I saw that light that took a river's form, light flashing, reddish gold, between two banks painted with wonderful spring flowerings. Out of that stream there issued living sparks, which settled on the flowers on all sides, like rubies set in gold, and then, as if intoxicated with the odors, they again plunged into the amazing flood. As one spark sank, another spark emerged. And then Beatrice tells Dante, that high desire that now inflames and incites you to grasp mentally the things you see pleases me more as it swells more.
Irene Virag, I don't know if you and your husband had that kind of interaction in your garden, but we're right out there on the edge of paradise there with Dante, Irene.
Sometimes, to bring it slightly back down to earth a little bit,
yes.
Gardens are hard work. They really are. And since we've been talking about Carol Kapok, one of the sentences, two of his sentences that I love him for are, there are several different ways to lay out a little garden. The best way is to get a gardener. And to me, that sums up, you know, it's hard work. And there's poetry in the peonies, but there's a lot of sweat and tears and a lot of treachery, too. And I don't know if you're familiar with the late, great garden columnist of the Washington Post, Henry Mitchell, but he talks about gardening as an act of love, an act of faith, and an act of defiance. And he writes that there are just gardeners and non-gardeners. Gardeners are the ones who, ruin after ruin, get on with the high defiance of nature herself. You may see the natural way in any desert, any swamp, any leached-filled laurel hell. Defiance, on the other hand, is what makes us gardeners.
That's wonderful. Chew on that one, Dante. Irene Virag at Newsday, it's so wonderful to have you. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
And Professor Robert Pogue Harrison, that tension between that sweat and labor and defiance of nature and its embrace and repose all in one, there's the charm, whether it's an Islamic garden or Dante's own.
All right, and one favorite line of mine from Chopik, just to conclude, is you must always give the soil more than you take away from it, which I think is a principle, an ethical principle, as well as a gardening principle.
There's the vocation of care. Robert Pogue Harrison in Rome joining us today. The book is Gardens, an Essay on the Human Condition. So glad to have you. We'll go out with songs from a Persian garden. Thank you so much, Professor Harrison.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
Listeners, you can continue the conversation and download the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.